This is JS Party, a weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Connect with us in our community Slack. It's totally free. Head to jsparty.fm/community and sign up today. Thank you to our partners for helping us bring you world-class developer pods each and every week. Shout out to Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
Hello, JS Party listeners. It's Amel Hussein here. We're back with a super important and very timely show. We've got a hot topic and some like just incredible guests and incredible co-panelists to help me kind of unpack this. So with me on the panel today is Firas. Hello, Firas.
Hey, Amel. How's it going? It's good to be back on the show in a little while.
Yeah. You're like I said before we recorded, I was like, you're taking a break from saving the internet security to come like record a podcast. So we really appreciate you joining us for us. And we have a very, very special guest with us today, Darcy Clark. Hello. Welcome, Darcy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're pumped. So Darcy and I spent some time working together when I was at NPM. We had some overlap. He stayed on after the acquisition and kind of continued shepherding the NPM CLI and the community ecosystem. Darcy's just, longtime kind of contributor to the JavaScript ecosystem, has been really kind of focused on developer tooling for many years. We're just thrilled to have him on the show. But Darcy, like, I'm not doing your introduction any justice. So please, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
No, I think you covered most of it. I think I've been writing code for almost 2 decades and doing something in the midst of product strategy or engineering work. And most recently was at GitHub for the last 2.5 years, helping manage the NPM CLI team. Before that, was part of the NPM Inc. prior to that acquisition. And so really heads down and deep in package management, supply chain, and JavaScript ecosystem. So everything open source as well. Our team supported over 100 projects and roughly 3 billion installs a month, which is kind of crazy. So yeah,
that's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your background, Darcy. And honestly, like, you're just also one of the most passionate human beings I know and have ever worked with. Like, you're extremely passionate about the developer ecosystem, really passionate about community work. You did a ton of really cool stuff at NPM, just starting to kind of re-engage with the community, whether it was, kind of kickstarting the RFC process and all kinds of stuff. So I just wanted to say thank you for all your contributions. And so what we're here to talk to you about today is a pretty massive bug that you reported on June 27th of 2023, just a few days ago. You reported kind of a pretty big vulnerability at the heart of the NPM ecosystem. And so can you tell us a little bit about what that is? We're going to set a bunch of context, but can you just give us like a few words for what the problem is?
Yeah, so I've coined it manifest confusion. I'm not sure if that's the best way to interpret it. For us, might have a different way we should be maybe considering it, but that's the name of the bug, and sort of it's just inconsistency between the metadata about packages and the actual contents of that metadata or the contents of the tarball. So that's the core issue. We can dive into that a bit more, but we'd love to lay some context down around what exactly is the registry and the client itself. So
yeah, and to kind of give some to meat to the problem for us, can you tell us why this is bad?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure Darcy will have a plenty of thoughts too. But if I had to sum it up, I'd say it basically allows an attacker to hide install scripts or extra dependencies inside of a package, and a lot of tools won't show those hidden install scripts or dependencies, even though they're going to get installed and they're going to get run. And so it gives an attacker really like a pretty powerful tool to hide some of the stuff they might be up to. I don't know if I did it justice, Darcy, but that's kind of the...
That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're anything like me, listeners, and you're thinking, wow, this sounds like a really bad problem and I can't believe it's still live and it's a thing, we're going to get into like why this, we're going to get into the timelines. We're going to get into like the impact and like all of the things that led to this. But we're going to first set some context for you all so that you understand the architecture of a package and like, and also the NPM ecosystem as a whole. There's a client and a registry. There's multiple clients, multiple registries in theory. So Darcy, can you kind of just give us the overview of this ecosystem, which maybe is very abstracted for most folks outside of the tooling world.
So the NPM ecosystem is actually based off, the architecture is based off of a sort of decentralized model, although the NPM registry is where we look to for the majority of the packages in our ecosystem. And what we find is that there's a metadata component as well as the actual artifact host component, so the tarball that's being hosted in the NPM registry. And so there's sort of two pieces to the puzzle here. Usually there's the registry, which is the server that's hosting the packages, and there's also usually clients which interact with that. You can imagine these are just like SDKs or, in our case, package managers that interface with those API endpoints. But there's also a whole bunch of proxy registries that have been spun up in the last decade. There's private registry hosts like the Artifactories or Nexus, Sontype's Nexus products. There's also even an open source proxy registry project called Verdaccio, which some people have used to help with testing or sort of mounting workspace or monorepo projects so they can test sort of staged packages as if they were in the registry. So there's a few different options for people out there if they want to host their packages somewhere other than the NPM registry. But most of these third-party tools actually do upstream and connect to the canonical NPM registry. So they copy a lot of the metadata, they copy a lot of the artifacts and store them themselves, almost like they've cached the requests from the canonical version. This is no different than if you were to download and install and save a local copy of those packages. Ideally, you'd save both the metadata as well as the tarball. And so that's sort of a high level overview of sort of what the architecture is like and sort of the players, I guess, in the space.
Okay. So developer has some code in a repo and they have a package JSON and they hit npm publish. What happens next?
Quite a few things. And this is where things go wrong or things can go wrong. So depending on your package manager, there might be a few steps that are taken prior to actually making that API request. And so this is really where I sort of dug in and started to see some problems with how we were doing this sort of handshake with the registry. So in the case of NPM and publish, NPM, the way that the client interacts with the registry, we actually run a few steps. A pre-pack, a pre-publish script can be run, and we will basically package up and create a few different values, an integrity value of the packaged tarball. And we'll also walk through, there's a couple steps in between this, but we will walk through the file contents and your configuration for what exactly you do want packaged. And then we'll also run some scripts if you've defined them for the different sort of hooks that we have within that process. And just before we actually push to the public registry, we'll extract the package JSON, normalize it, and then finally publish that alongside the tarball. So this is where you can start to see there might be an issue here in the fact that there's actually a difference between the metadata that's being published separately from the actual tarball.
So here's our first point of inflection, you know?
Yeah, this is like where you start to... When I saw this and I thought about this a bit more, it really came to a head. I was really concerned with what was and wasn't happening on the other side of this dance. So the client for sure was where I was living and breathing for the last 4 years. I wasn't spending a ton of time on the registry side of this equation. And so I got to get, you know, very familiar very quickly with what we were and weren't doing on the validation side and in terms of making sure that the metadata that had been presented to us was being validated against what actually was in the tarball.
Darcy, I got a question though. So why do you think this decision was made? I mean, what would be the reason that the registry would want to have a copy of a file that's already in the package and pull, you know, duplicate that information? Just maybe it would be helpful to go through kind of like why that might have been done.
Totally. So I actually did, in my research, I went way back. You talk about code splunking sometimes, trying to look at the history of how something was created. And I went back basically over a decade to the very beginning when Isaac Schluter was working, you know, furiously on both the CLI, the registry, as well as, you know, was a very active and champion for Node itself. So had a lot going on at that time. And I looked at the first few iterations of the registry side of this, or the registry client. And I think we'll have in the show notes a reference to that actual registry client. And I think the reason why this was done was actually for performance. And also at that time, over a decade ago, the ecosystem was really small, right? There's only a few trusted people publishing anything to the registry. So I don't think that the idea that maybe there could be inconsistency from the client to at all made sense, right? Like, I don't think that we were at such a smaller place in our ecosystem. We were in the infancy. I don't think that this decision that was made to upload these two things independently of one another, or have them be two independent pieces of data, I don't think that it was thought of as bad architecture probably back then, because you couldn't imagine interfacing with the registry, not with one of these clients, not with the NPM client. And I think what has changed over the last 10 years, decade, is that there's more clients, there's more use cases to hit the registry itself without using sort of this privileged way of interfacing with the NPM backend.
It also feels like maybe part of it is that certain information is useful to just have without having to go into the package itself and pull it out. Like, just if you're trying to build like a website, like npmjs.com, maybe having like the high level info, like the README and the list of dependencies, just there, you know, in an easy to consume format might have been part of it, instead of having to, you know, unzip or untar a whole bunch of packages to generate those pages. That maybe, I don't know, maybe that came later. I'm not sure if that's historically correct, but that was kind of the reason I always assumed that it was done that way.
It does seem like that is a super valuable reason, right? Like, to have that kind of information live alongside the package itself and to be able to share some metadata. You could have, like you said, you could have done it on the server side and extracted it. So that's why I say it's probably a performance reason that they did this. It was easy and available to the client that had access to that metadata. So why try to extract it again on the server side? Why go through that extra step? But you are essentially crossing that boundary and ensuring that there's consistency with the data is kind of crucial. So it seems like it was a fundamental flaw in how that was kind of architected.
Yeah, I mean, relying on clients to do validation is like, you know, it's like one of the first things you learn when you're a developer. It's like, don't trust your client, you know. So it's interesting to see that we're so trusting, you know, of our client to handle all this complex data validation. So just in terms of terminology, this is a manifest, right? Like, this document that gets created. So there's a manifest, there's a tarball. And so in terms of kind of the ecosystem, just to give you all examples, like, there's, you know, things like Yarn, right? Or PNPM are clients that connect in with your, you know, whatever registry you kind of pointed to. And there's tools like Verdaccio. I was very close to saying Versace. Didn't say it. Did I even say, I don't even know if I said it correctly. Is it Verdaccio? Versace?
As far as I know, it's Verdaccio. Yeah, you said it.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Not Versace. Yeah, could you tell us what tools like Versaccio are, Darcy? Versace. Did I say Versaccio? Oops, yeah. Sorry.
I think that's great brand association, I'm sure. So a tool like Verdaccio actually connects upstream and caches. It acts as a registry proxy, and it helps also teams that are doing things with workspaces, or they just want to have their own instance of a private NPM registry. It sort of has backwards engineered the APIs of the NPM registry, because that's one key thing here as well with this discovery, is just that there's just so much undocumented behavior and undocumented APIs with the NPM registry, which unfortunately has been the case for quite a while. And we've, as a community, really had to leverage the clients themselves and folks that have, you know, paved paths to playing with the registry to actually figure out how to interface with it. And that's the one unfortunate thing is I think this would have been caught a lot earlier if those APIs were better documented. So I tip my hat to the team behind Verdaccio. They did a lot of work to sort of backwards engineer and build a proxy registry implementation. And so a lot of teams use that to self-host and serve packages. But again, it's very similar to JFrog's Artifactory products. And there's some new players in this space like Cloudsmith that are also helping teams, enterprises have private registry instances. And so the interesting piece here is that you can configure your client to connect to these proxies, and then they will essentially hydrate their state and store any packages from the public registry you would be requesting. So they actually copy the metadata or the manifest that we're talking about, as well as the tarballs, so that you know you don't make two round trips every single time. They help you cache and store. They also provide insights. So similar to, I'm sure the work that Sake is doing, you know, there's some insights that they add to these products that help you understand a bit more about your consumption. A lot of these products also help you write policies and enforce policies for the consumption of your upstream packages.
Yeah, all the things that in theory should have, in a perfect world, be built into the NPM registry. You know, it's like, that's the thing when I worked at NPM, that was so painful. It was like, you know, it's like, man, like there's such a backlog of things that this thing should do or could do. And there's a whole ecosystem of tools, very profitable companies that are built around all the gaps in the ecosystem. Even just some things like Unpackage, like what Unpackage did to like, that's something NPM should have very easily been able to just do, right? But it's just, again, for a myriad of reasons, which we'll get into very soon, you know, that we, yeah, it's like the little engine that could and should, but never did, you know? So yeah, so let's, maybe this is a good time to segue into that. I really wanted to talk about like mirroring and all this, like how do companies actually set up that infrastructure, like large companies like Google or Stripe or whatever, like people have mirrored registries. And so I'm going to put that nerdly quest aside. So let's get into like, why is this so broken? Why is this so bad, right? So like there's just been a myriad of issues with the NPM registry and just, you know, whether things are not documented, like there's just been a whole series of things. And so what are your thoughts on this, Darcy? Because I have my own, so.
Yeah, I have many thoughts. I'm not sure. I must be careful with how I maybe bring up my thoughts.
Phrase them.
Yeah. But, you know, I care very deeply about the JavaScript ecosystem. I think everybody that's come in and through NPM really has had that same passion about building a great product. So it is unfortunate that we weren't able to capitalize on maybe some of these opportunities, but it's awesome that, you know, companies like Socket and Feroz are doing amazing work to sort of pick up where there's these gaps. In terms of the investments that are being made today, you know, I can't speak to the intentions behind the Microsoft engine or GitHub broadly, but, you know, I think that they've seen that there's, you know, a lot of work to be done in the developer space and sort of code creation. And GitHub's, if you look at the entire platform, it's amazing at building collaboration tools and building source code management like tools. But I don't know if they really understand distribution that well or that sort of other side of the code. Creation and consumption are sort of two sides of the same problem. And so I always looked at NPM as sort of being the platform for distribution. And so I think that maybe there's some more investments that need to be made and more sort of cross collaboration that could be done, I think, with the products that now GitHub owns that would make, you know, really benefit us as consumers. But yeah, I don't know exactly why there's been so many issues. I think we've had some exponential growth, which I know you want to speak to, which the JavaScript community is by far and large the majority of the repositories that you see on GitHub. It's the largest ecosystem or software index and registry in the world. So you saw the exponential growth. So, you know, we are the first ones to, I think, experience kind of like problems with supply chains and the problems with how we orchestrate massive dependency graphs and how you really try to figure out how to manage this web of trust. And so our ecosystem, I think, is going to be the one at the forefront of figuring out what good tooling looks like. And a lot of folks have come to me in the last few years and said, you know, NPM is actually a great package manager compared to what we have in this ecosystem or that ecosystem. And so they've actually been very excited to see you. It's funny because we always complain about our tools in our ecosystem and everybody's ready to jump onto something new. But we are actually in a very privileged position just with how much we care about solving these problems and how we're always willing to keep pushing, even though we're on the edge there. So I would say it's a unique position we're in. And I'm not sure if that speaks to, you know, why we're this way. Maybe Firas has other thoughts on that.
I mean, I just want to second what you just said about how NPM is actually pretty great, especially when compared to what came before it. I mean, it solved dependency hell in the sense that you can install any set of dependencies and the package manager will never tell you, hey, you have, you know, two different versions of the same package. I'm sorry, you have, you know, your whole project is messed up now and you can't proceed. It also made publishing really easy and welcoming. And that's, you know, why we have such like a huge community. I think it was brilliant to make publish be such a core part of the package manager and to like get rid of the gatekeeping process and just like let the creativity go wild and let everybody just put, I mean, even putting non-JavaScript code on NPM. I mean, I think for a while Substack was putting like C code on NPM and people just use it for all kinds of really amazing and like innovative things. And I mean, it hosts front end code now, which it was not really the intention originally. You know, it's, and now WASM, I mean, it's really incredible. So I think as we get into all the kind of problems with NPM, we shouldn't forget like how amazing it was and how many good ideas were in there. And also just seconding your point about how JavaScript is, we're the biggest ecosystem. So we're going to face all the problems first. And that doesn't mean that like, you know, there's a lot of people that like to jump on that and say like, oh, look how like doomed, you know, the JavaScript ecosystem is, or like, look how bad it is because of this reason or that reason. And certainly with like the supply chain attacks that happen, you know, they tend to come in the JavaScript ecosystem and PyPy now a little bit more. And it's not necessarily because like there's anything wrong with those languages or those communities, or it's really just the size. It's like, why does Windows get all the malware? I mean, it's definitely a part of the story that the haters, I guess, like to leave out. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Haters are always going to hate, but yeah, no. And thanks for setting that context. You know, I think for me, there's just a ton of like, just the rate that we're able to innovate. Right. I think that it's just a culture. It's just part of the JavaScript community's DNA, you know, is innovation is just core and rapid innovation at that. It's like, I can do this. Like, let's just do this. Okay. It's done. It's published. Go use my idea. Right. That's just core for me. Like, it's just that the growth of the Node community is just, for me, like a huge contributor to what we might see as feature gaps, right? Like within the NPM ecosystem, like just such a small team managing a huge hockey stick ride, you know, just in the course of from 0 to 10 years, like, you know, going from zero to serving, you know, billions of packages, you know, a month. I mean, that's something that like every single person that's worked on the CLI or registry should be incredibly proud of, you know? And so I think what we see as gaps are really just, you know, for me, I see them as like a result of just poor management, leadership, resources, like resource constraints, you know, like lack of kind of maybe strong community engagement early on, and you know, having a bit more of a, maybe something like a Node steering committee, like handling like the NPM like ecosystem, you know, in a more neutral way. There's so many things, but yeah, so I think, you know, before we kind of get into some of these problems, like just some context there and some empathy for the team, but the problems are real, right? So there's, first of all, like for me, the biggest shocker is like that we don't things aren't validated, you know, package JSON content doesn't go through a validation. That's just wild. Like you could say that my repo lives here, but it doesn't actually have to live, like it doesn't have to live there. You could say your license is this, but it could be something else. Like nothing's like, very little's required, you know, beyond name. And I don't even know what else. So, you know, just stuff like that. And then the lack of documentation in the APIs, not lack of, it's just no documentation of the registry APIs, really. Like that's just like wild, you know, people having to kind of, yeah.
Yeah. What I'll say as well, in terms of like the people aspect of this equation, definitely like in terms of GitHub going through significant changes in the last 4 or 5 years, post acquisition of Microsoft, many great people have left, unfortunately, GitHub and moved on to start new businesses. You know, you sort of get that usually post acquisition. Same thing happened with the NPM acquisition. Quite a few folks that were a part of that organization are no longer there. And in fact, part of the timeline that I have for this issue has, you know, a critical point there where we see layoffs at GitHub. And even this past week, you see that, you know, there's been some instability in their platform. So I think as you have that kind of churn, as you have great people come in, but then leave, you start to get concerned maybe about operational excellence. You get concerned about, you know, what it looks like for the future of certain products. Are they critical to the long-term, you know, roadmaps of product leadership? So those are all question marks, I think, in my mind long term for NPM being a home at GitHub, unfortunately. But I am excited about, you know, what's next for myself, for folks like Firas as well. And we can speak a little bit to that timeline, but also willing to jump to.
No, I appreciate that. And I guess, you know, last thing I'll say on this is that for me, it was, you know, I was part of NPM and was part of the group that was, you know, part of the layoffs. Maybe you are familiar with this or not. The acquisition was pretty, a little bit bloody. You know, a lot of people were put either on contract or laid off. So it was like, what was it? You don't have a job or you're not going to have a job soon. So that was the kind of
stance. Start interviewing.
Yeah, start interviewing. Yeah. For like majority of folks. And so, you know, fortunately, Darcy, being the face of the community, was one of the few people that didn't have to go through that. Really happy because
I interviewed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, and did? Okay.
And I think I told you this in private, but I'll say I took a pay cut as well. So that's, if anybody's out there thinking that it was a great acquisition for everybody involved, it wasn't necessarily. Yeah,
it was rough. It was a bloodbath. And thanks for sharing that on air. You know, but like I for me, the silver lining of this was like, whoa, you know, at least NPM is now going to be part of a large company with a large, like with a big set of resources and support and the infra to take in and kind of re-architect and reinvest. And that was, I was like, okay, that's the silver lining here, you know? So let's focus on the big picture. Like, you know, big picture is hopefully this is good for the ecosystem. And, you know, and to kind of find out, you know, just through the grapevine that, yeah, no, all the same problems still exist. And actually they're kind of worse now because we have even less subject matter experts on staff and the, you know, rotation of people. Like how many times have they changed teams now? Three?
Yeah. Like roughly three. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there's a skeleton crew managing the entire ecosystem, you know, seven people who are, you know, just anyways, it's very disappointing. So let's get into kind of this bug and the timeline like behind the discovery of this issue. So can you walk us through?
Yeah, I can walk through the timeline. I would love to also compare notes. I know for us and Socket team also had some independent research done in this space. But what I'll say is, you know, it seems like this bug, it could also be coined a feature. It's been around since the beginning of time, at the very beginning of the registry. So I just want to be mindful the way that I talk about the timeline of discovery, at least is through the lens of my discovery and research of this. So there's probably other folks, and in fact, I've talked to many other folks that have said they've independently seen this issue and just didn't realize maybe the scope and impact that it has on security tools, insights, and what it could mean if bad actors took advantage of this. So that I just want to preface that anything that I say next in terms of timelines, that, you know, this was my own like independent understanding of how I came to this. But July 28th, we actually saw the NPM CLI team had a issue opened against it, public issue by a user complaining about binding.jip errors and essentially install script errors and binding.jip sort of inconsistencies. And it's basically saying that there was or wasn't inconsistency when I think the node.jip script was being run when they saw or didn't see a binding.jip file in your package. So this bug, I think I've linked it here, was initially triaged by somebody on my team, Michael Garvin, on October 22nd.
And to be clear, this is 2022. I just want to make sure that we set
right.
That
yeah, sorry.
For the, yeah.
Hopefully people are listening back and we haven't solved this problem in a decade from now. But oh, so about a few months later, because unfortunately, we had such a backlog of issues with NPM and the NPM CLI team. We really went through it. One of my team members, Michael Garvin, actually triaged the issue on October 22nd and initially thought the person was sort of referencing just the fact that they couldn't ignore scripts or sort of turn on and off the ability to actually run lifecycle scripts, which are typical within the process of installing a package. We run a bunch of scripts very similar to the publish process, where we run a bunch of scripts that users can define and do certain things pre and post publishing. And so he brought that actually up to the team, and we also all looked at it independently. And what I realized pretty quickly on my own, that this likely was an issue, a more broader scoped issue, that there seemed to be problems with how we were caching or essentially rehydrating the state of the metadata, the manifest that we were holding around in memory. So the problem seemed to be, if you had flushed your cache, you didn't hold on to that context, the metadata that you had gotten from the registry, and instead we were hydrating it from the local package JSON. And now we thought those two things should be the same. We were making the same mistake that I think a lot of people make, and we were all under the assumption that those two things would be the same. And so that's where I saw some inconsistency. So on November 2nd, so about a week later, I actually wrote the first POC, or proof of concept, and published it to the registry. So there's a package in the registry called Darcy Clark -testing-malformed. And you actually go find that. You can see that that was published on November 4th. And that's actually the same day, November 2nd. And then a few days later, after publishing that, I internally wrote up a post about how I thought this might be a significant issue. We should probably look into this and let the rest of GitHub know. Unfortunately, I decided to quit GitHub shortly after this, filing that internally. I left GitHub December 2nd. So that was my last day for a number of reasons.
It was just because of this bug, really. That's why, right? That was like the primary driver. It was like, you know what? This manifest, you know what? Like, I'm out. Mic drop. Boom. You know, it's like, this is too much.
One bug too many. This was the one that broke.
Yes. Yeah. It was issue number 6666. You know, that's it. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. So I had decided to leave, and there was a number of reasons why there, but so I left in December. I took some time off in December, and then in the new year, I began to wonder what had happened to that issue. I started to do some independent research again. There was actually a number of issues that were public on the NPM CLI repo, but also public across all the package managers. Like, some, this inconsistency was creeping up in weird ways. Like, it is actually the cause for many bugs that people don't even realize it's the cause for. So
the mismatch between like local package JSON and manifest, like what's actually totally stored in the manifest. Okay.
Yeah. The assumption really that we all have had is that if you save back down a tarball and you actually extract it and you put the contents onto your system somewhere, the idea is that you have almost all the information you need about that package to use it and consume it. Unfortunately, what this API, the way that it was built now, says is actually you need both two things. You need both this manifest and this metadata and the tarball, and you have to carry those around all the time. And it also calls into question just which one is the source of truth, right? So that's why we can tell there's a code smell here in terms of the architecture, because really you should be able to hydrate the state of most of that metadata by just reading from the local package JSON, right? Like, what dependencies, what license, what scripts, what's the name, what's the version? Those are two critical pieces of information which actually can be falsified inside of a tarball. So hitting on sort of where I was at, roughly around March, I decided to look into the problem again and actually realized that the scope was a lot broader than I even initially thought. I realized all clients are basically affected by this. The third-party tools we were talking about before, the proxy registries like the Artifactories and Nexus and Verdaccios, who are all copying and, as you said, sort of mirroring the registry, are copying and cloning this information, this inaccurate information. And so there's really a whole bunch of caches out in the world that are hosting inconsistent data. And so it's a really serious and significant issue. And if somebody, a bad actor, you know, finds this, they can sort of find a way, as Firas so elegantly put it, hide malicious scripts, hide known malware dependencies in a tarball and not get flagged by security tools, not get flagged by advisory tools. And so this is the serious issue that I realized at that point. So the timeline goes on. March 8th, I actually uploaded a new POC, which started to play with some of those values in terms of the scripts and the dependencies, as well as the name and version, to showcase that actually there was a whole series of issues here, including downgrade attacks, cache poisoning, and a number of other issues. And as of March 9th, I submitted a new HackerOne report to GitHub to let them know about the scope and all of my research. I'm not sure, for us, I saw you start shaking your head. Do you want to jump in there at some point?
No, that all sounds good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can just say from the socket side, like, we kind of independently, I guess, fixed this bug back on September 5th when we were refactoring some code. It just sort of came up like, there's a different, you know, set of information in the registry than there is in the package. What should we use? And then we decided to go with what the CLI tools use, which is what's in the package. And so we kind of just made that fix as part of a broader like refactor that we were doing to our install process. So once I heard about this issue from you, I was glad that, like, you know, we were using the right data as, you know, as far as it goes, you know, from a security perspective. But even we didn't handle everything perfectly. Our website actually was using the metadata from the registry. And so the website was showing as if, you know, we were, you know, unaware of these dependencies that were hidden in packages, even though our security analysis was actually using, you know, the correct manifest file under the hood. So that just shows, you know, even like a, you know, we took this, you know, we take security super seriously, and like, it's the whole point of our product. And, you know, even we kind of use two different data sources. You know, fortunately the website, you know, is not as important as the actual security analysis, but just goes to show you kind of like how insidious this kind of inconsistency is, and how basically every tool in the ecosystem has to, you know, deal with the differences now. I also just wanted to add to like how grateful I am that you're raising awareness about this issue. For those who don't know, like, Darcy's been talking about this, not this specific issue, but this sort of general issue of different tools treating dependencies differently, to the point where, you know, I think I saw in your most recent talk at the open source summit in Vancouver, this like amazing slide which shows when you go to install a particular dependency, just the number of dependencies that actually get installed varies so significantly between different package managers, to the point where you wonder, like, are we even running like the same package? I mean, it was like hundreds of packages just get installed in NPM that don't get installed in Yarn, or in Yarn installs like, you know, different number than PNPM installs. And it's like, what is going on here? How does the software even work when the numbers are so different? That's kind of the feeling that you get from it. And it's something that I'm glad you're raising awareness about, because, you know, we need to know what we're talking about when we're running software. Like, what are we actually running? You know, and there's just so little like understanding of what should get installed. I mean, there's no standards around this stuff. So, I mean, I think you're raising it to the surface in many ways, not just this manifest confusion attack, but also just kind of how the tooling needs to get kind of all on the same page in a lot of ways. And also just how, honestly, just how sloppy some of the security tooling out there really is. I mean, just a lot of people just, you know, aren't even, I mean, I think you mentioned in your post kind of like all the different tools that were affected by this, and it's really just something to see, I think. So Anyway, really grateful for you for surfacing these issues.
Yeah, plus one. It's not easy, you know? And so, yeah, I think for me, what was really insightful about your timeline is that you submitted this report to GitHub. You did the thing. You know, and what happened next?
Yeah, so I privately disclosed I want to do the right thing, like, and make sure that I could collaborate. Like, I was really concerned about the scope and companies like Socket. Like, I want to reach out. I believe I did actually reach out and disclose with Firas actually back in December. So it was shortly after I had left GitHub, actually reached out privately and also disclosed with Firas. Obviously, it sounds like they were already protected. So you know, I disclosed. It was March 9th, they left me hanging for a couple weeks, and by March 21st they got back and closed the ticket, actually saying that they were going to handle it internally, which I was kind of disappointed about, because I was really hoping to collaborate on reaching out to, I think, the affected parties to privately disclose if possible. It just seemed like there might be some, you know, key players in the space that would want to know about this, and or sort of like GitHub and npm be the first to sort of announce this. So yeah, you know, there was an opportunity there for them to do that, and they didn't. They decided to close it. And so about a week later after that happened, surprisingly enough, I'm not sure if it was coincidence, but GitHub actually laid off their entire engineering team in India. And I don't know if it's well known or not, but a majority of the registry team had actually been moved to India at that point. So when you talk about the small team that exists now that's supporting that infrastructure, there was a major layoff there for those folks. So I got a bit concerned when I saw those layoffs. I got a bit concerned about the timeline that I could expect them to really work. As they said, they were going to work internally and they weren't going to provide updates to myself through the HackerOne report or anything. They obviously weren't willing to collaborate. And especially given how much time I had invested in the research and done, like, you know, significant work to figure out who I thought might be the key folks. It was super disappointing. So I waited roughly 3 months. I sat around for roughly 3 months on this before finally deciding to announce this past week and write the blog post and share it with folks and let them know. So the announcement that I was starting my new company, Volt, happened on Monday. And then Tuesday, we published on our blog the article. Critically enough, it's the first article on the blog post. I thought it was that important that we get it out there, and appreciate folks like Firas helped work with some media, and we got some buzz around this and trying to make this visible to the ecosystem so that they can protect themselves.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. And I know that the blog post has made its rounds, like, you know, it's getting a lot of eyeballs. I'm curious to hear, like, what feedback, like, what are most people like? I'm sure they're just shocked. They're like, huh, really? You know, but what's been the feedback on your blog post?
So there was some follow-on blog posts. I know for us, his team had a follow-up one as well to provide a bit more context, clarity about the work that they had done. I got the feedback from my side was just, you know, wow, oh my gosh, another issue. Like, a lot of people, I'm sure, have a bit of fatigue at this point about the number of issues that unfortunately our community has faced and the registry has faced and the CLI has faced. So, you know, I'm sure some folks are tuning out just the noise. And I hope they don't do that. I think this is one of those critical, really, really critical issues that fundamentally is going to be tough to fix. I actually have a lot of empathy for NPM and GitHub in this space. I hope that came across in the blog post. There's a section in there where I say this is not going to be an easy thing to fix, just because the validation has not been in place for over a decade. So we have a lot of packages to go through and double check their name and version on every single one of them, because those two pieces of information can actually be, like I said, falsified or changed. And yet the rest of that information in that package JSON inside the tarball should be probably the canonical source of truth. So I say probably because I'm not the person to enforce it until I publish my new product. So.
Yeah, no, that's so, I mean, of course, like there's so many things that come to mind here. One being like, I'm like, it's so disappointing to see such a large company with so many resources just kind of really mishandle the reporting of this and just even taking ownership and trying to resolve it and address it. And so, any thoughts on this? I kind of want to shake GitHub and be like, why, you know, like, but obviously I can't do that. You know, they have tons of money. They could prioritize this work, but they don't, you know, and it's like, you know, if you don't want to take care of the ecosystem, then like, maybe we should, the socialist in me is like, you know, we should like, you know, it should be a foundation or should be centrally managed or whatever else. But, you know, it's, this is just like, I don't know. For me, this is like unacceptable.
Yeah, it's definitely tough to think about a future without some canonical or sort of centralized registry, unfortunately, because it does cost, like the costs are pretty significant. Maintenance is pretty high. So I do have a lot of empathy for the folks that do maintain the infrastructure. But you're right, you know, in October, GitHub announced they had hit 1 billion ARR. They are making 1 billion USD revenue. And the investments that they make are should be telling to the ecosystem about what they do and don't prioritize. And it's unfortunate that there's a lot of these things that go unprioritized or they're slow to react to. Again, this is as far as I know, it's more than 6 months they've known about this. So,
this is a Changelog news break. Can you trust ChatGPT's package recommendations? Not so much. The team at Vulkan have published a new security threat vector they're calling AI Package Hallucination.
That sounds good. I'll have that.
It relies on the fact that ChatGPT sometimes answers questions with hallucinated sources, links, blogs, and statistics. It'll even generate questionable fixes to CVEs and offer links to libraries that don't actually exist.
What about the ROUSs?
Rodents of unusual size? I don't think they exist.
Quote, when the attacker finds a recommendation for an unpublished package, they can publish their own malicious package in its place. The next time a user asks a similar question, they may receive a recommendation from ChatGPT to use the now existing malicious package. End quote. These AI tools like ChatGPT are a real boost to developer productivity, but be careful out there. You just heard one of our five top stories from Monday's Changelog News. Subscribe to the podcast to get all of the week's top stories and pop your email address in at changelog.com/news to also receive our free companion email with even more developer news worth your attention. Once again, that's changelog.com/news.
All right. Well, I mean, we're going to have to move this into a positive direction, which is, you know, how do we dig ourselves out of this hole, Darcy? So what's being done to kind of resolve this? And for us, obviously, you're resident expert on supply chain and security and all that jazz. So I'm very curious to hear from you, too. Like, how do we get out of this? Because there's, for me, like, one answer is specs, you know, having, you know, like ECMAScript is the standard. Lots of different engines develop to that same standard, you know, so there's room for all these tools in our ecosystem. Let's just have a spec that we are all developing up against. That's one, but I don't think that's going to solve everything. So, yeah, what do you all think?
Well, I'm just curious what Darcy thinks about. I mean, like, what would break if we just, I mean, if GitHub just did the easy, the obvious thing, which is to validate that the metadata in the registry is the same as the package? I mean, do you know of anything that would actually break? Or isn't that just like the most straightforward solution here to just make sure that reflects the actual contents of the package? And then we can just move on from this? Like, why isn't that the easy solution here? I'd love to understand what you think.
Sure. So with most like easy questions, there's a complex answer or nuanced answer. Unfortunately, I don't have an easy answer for you. After spending 4 years or almost 4 years managing the world's largest package manager, you know, really supporting the JavaScript community, you learn that, you know, even the smallest fix affects someone in a big way. It might affect somebody's production system. We learned very quickly, my team or myself, like when I onboarded to NPM, that even making a bug fix might break someone because they were relying on the bug, right? So we learned very quickly that actually the ecosystem has learned to grow around the tooling, and they actually have started to rely on the bugs in the infrastructure and in the tooling. So I've talked with some engineering folks, I won't name names, but large engineering organizations that are actually very concerned about NPM, I think, fixing this, because it might break them in nuanced, weird ways, because they might be relying on the inconsistent behavior. So that's one concern. So I think that to do the easy thing still requires a lot of communication, a lot of lead way for organizations to get prepared for that. And it's not necessarily that easy. So like you said, the path forward should be to ensure that maybe the tarballs package JSON is the canonical source of truth for that metadata that we actually rely on at the API level, and should be validated or extracted out of that tarball. And you should almost not even be required to pass a manifest because there's no point, really. I think that is the path forward that they'll take eventually, that NPM probably should take. But there's a bunch of discovery work that needs to happen, and maybe your team could do this to basically validate the existing 3 million plus packages to see whether or not the contents of that package, specifically the name and version, are not aligned with the name and version that package was published under. So that's one of the key issues that I would say is at play here, is that you could actually falsify the name and version of in your package JSON in a tarball today, and that does not get validated by the registry. And there's some weird, the package managers themselves, the clients, as we were talking about, handle those use cases in very weird ways. So you can essentially co-opt or steal a package name and do some interesting things in certain situations. So that's one of those nuances of this problem that I think needs to be handled carefully. So I don't think it's a straightforward change that they'll have to make. And in terms of where we go going forward, I'm with you, Amal. I'm all for standards. Frost was speaking to this a bit. I care deeply about how we interpret your dependency graph, and I think that there's an opportunity for us to get on the same page. I liken it to before there was standards in the DOM and rendering your HTML markup, and browsers were all interpreting your HTML a bit different. And before HTML5, there was no standard way of handling all the edge cases of broken markup. And I think that working with foundations, which I'm really excited to do with my new company, work very closely with OpenJS Foundation, the Lynx Foundation, folks like the OpenSSF as well, that I know Frost is close with, working with those organizations to standardize how we interpret dependency graphs, I think is going to be very important. And that starts with standardizing some critical pieces of what a package is, like the semantic versioning spec, I think needs to some standard semantic versioning or semver APIs would be a great first step in the runtimes. And then moving on to what exactly is a package specification. What's that look like? It'd be great if Bun and Deno, the latest and greatest sort of quasi package managers, also participate in this, because as we grow the ecosystem, we start to see more and more implementations and nuances in your dependency graph. And it's really hard to build security tools and give everybody safety of mind that when they actually go to install a project, that's consistent and you have consistency across your dependencies. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, the HTML analogy was like spot on, you know, that's exactly it. And I think for me, that is a result of just the lack of kind of community herding early on, right? Like, and also just all of these different projects springing up and, you know, gaining different levels of traction within the community, you know, so it's really hard. I mean, even just like Yarn becoming a thing, I don't know what the backstory is, but like, I'm curious, for before they had released Yarn publicly outside of Facebook, or it was Facebook then, what was the engagement like? Because I know that you really helped bring community engagement along. Like you, I think I got to see that as part of your leadership, you know, bringing all these different stakeholders to the table and having a conversation. But I'm curious, just what was it like early days, just bringing these different folks to the table to talk about getting on the same page?
I think Yarn was launched in 2016, I believe. So I don't quite remember. And that was before my time at NPM. I don't quite remember what the engagement was like with the community, but I do know that actually NPM's RFC process was mimicked a bit by Yarn. Yarn had an RFC process, and that was also, I think, sort of copied from, I think, the IETF. Right? Is that the right standards body? There's another standards body that has a really good RFC program and so that kind of way of engaging with the community through open discourse and through live streams and having opportunities for people to engage in different ways with your open source project, I think was really critical to hearing what people actually wanted from us. And I was really proud of what we had done with NPM over the last 3.5-4 years with the RFC program. And we had over 100 hours of live streamed videos and live stream meetings on YouTube there. And so we, I think, did more in the last little while to try to fix and correct that relationship with the community and try to mend some broken trust. But obviously NPM hasn't gone far enough. And so I'm really excited about what I can do with my new company and where we can go with that, and the kind of relationships we'll be building, hopefully are strong ones with partners like Frost, maybe, or, you know, open source folks that are looking to make sure we build for the next 5 to 10, you know, the next few decades, look to build a good foundation. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, it's a really good segue to say, so what's next for you, Darcy, as we're kind of wrapping up this conversation? I mean, this was a deep one. It's a, you know, obviously it's hard to kind of walk away from this conversation not really even having a clear solution and like clear resolution on like next steps. You know, what are action items? That's like, that's what I want to do, right? Like, get some bullet points going and delegate some, you know, some tasks.
Well, I will say there is some folks in the community. I actually saw someone had written a package validator package. I think I saw it today or just yesterday. So I'll definitely share that link with folks that are interested, just to see, you know, if you're affected or if you're interested in checking the and validating the contents of a package that you consume and want to make sure you're safe. Obviously, my recommendation also is to go to Socket. Socket's package pages now highlight, you know, inconsistency, and they actually, I think, have introduced a net new type of issue in their platform that's called manifest confusion. So my link, former link to my POC package page now has a bright red warning on it, which is great to see. So if you're trying to secure yourself, you're looking for next steps, I think, you know, Frost's company is doing a great job there and was really on the ball when I announced this week. So I'm not sure, Frost, do you know any other good next steps for folks if they're trying to protect themselves?
I mean, from this specific attack, I think the two things you mentioned are it. I mean, there's that tool that somebody released just to look for manifest confusion specifically. And then you're absolutely right. Socket can detect the manifest confusion issue now in any dependencies. So other than that, I mean, I guess we can also recommend probably that people should, you know, if they're using another type of tool for their dependency security, they should probably ask that vendor like what they're doing about this issue and just make sure that the vendor isn't using the registry metadata, and try putting Darcy's package into that tool and just see like what comes out. Does it actually catch the hidden dependency? Does it actually catch the install script? I mean, you can test your tools out. So if you think your tooling is protecting you, you know, you could just check to see if it handles Darcy's test package. So I think we should link that in the show notes as well for people.
Yeah, all this will be definitely linked in the notes. Yeah, and thanks for that great summary for us. Very helpful. And so, Darcy, we've kind of talked a little bit about Volt, like in passing, you've mentioned it. Can you just tell folks what is Volt?
Volt, VLT. Yeah, I apologize for the confusion preemptively. I know there's other tools in the ecosystem. People have already started to give me a hard time about the name. But VLT, or Volt, as I like to pronounce it, is a net new package manager, a JavaScript package manager, as well as a new registry. So we're going to be focused on, you know, competing with NPM, but also ensuring that we don't bifurcate the ecosystem. We're definitely going to have the same kind of capabilities that some of these other registry proxies have, and be able to upstream and make sure we bring the existing ecosystem along for the ride. So I'm going to hopefully provide a ton of extra value, and this gives us some greenfield space in terms of what we can do with the package manager. And the hope is to also help with the standards efforts here as we go forward. So really excited to get started. You can go to vlt.sh, sign up to be one of the first folks in our beta, and I would love to come back on and share more when we're fully launched. I also will be speaking at a conference a little bit more about it next month. I think for us may be there. It's a conference here in Toronto called Refactor DX. So focused on developer experience and developer tools. I believe we both have keynotes there, so that will be fun, or we both are speaking there. So excited to share more at that conference. And I know that our good friend Ahmed, I'm not sure how you folks say it.
Yes. You folks. Oh man, that's burn. That's okay. That's fine.
Oh, I meant just like it, both of you. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name.
Yes, no, I'm just kidding. I'm giving you a hard time.
Good friend, former CTO of NPM, then advisor to my company.
Yeah, person who also pressured me to speak at, well, not pressure, I should, yeah, but at ReFactorConf. And I, yes, unfortunately could not make it this year, but who knows? Miracles happen. So
hopefully you'll be there in some way, shape, or form.
In some way, yes. But yeah, so thank you so much for sharing all that, Darcy. Thank you for all the hard work that you contribute to this community. Everything we do is kind of built on community in JavaScript. It's like the core, it's like the bedrock foundation of how we collaborate, create, distribute, etc. And so just thank you for being kind of a lighthouse among us. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and talk about this. For those of you listening, the show notes are going to be packed with links. And if you have not given Darcy's blog post a read, please do. It's solid. It'll also help you better understand all the different things that happen in that little black box called node modules, you know? So yeah. So with that said, we'll close this out. Thank you again, Darcy. Where can folks connect with you and find you on the internet?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter, just at Darcy, my first name, which is great. I'm up there with Jason Calcanis and other folks, which have first name user accounts, which is great.
And for us. You guys are
Darcy's much more impressive of a name to get on Twitter than for us. I have to say, there's not that many for us.
Honestly, you should just change your Twitter handle to Darcy, not to be confused by Mark Darcy, Mark Darcy.
I get a lot of Mr. Darcy's, so there's a lot of Jane Austen fans that love to hit me up on Twitter. So very Mr. interesting.
Darcy. Oh yeah, I bet.
On GitHub, I'm Darcy Clark, my full name, and if you're looking for a very old website, darcyclark.me is my personal site, and of course, vlt.sh is my new company's website. So you can check me out there.
Hope to have you on the show once you've launched and you're further in your product journey. It's very exciting. So, all right, kids. So with that said, we've wrapped another show. We will catch you next week. Thank you all for listening. Have an amazing day.
All right. That is JS Party for this week. Thanks for listening. And thanks to Amel, Faraz, and our guest, Darcy Clark, for the awesome conversation. If you have thoughts on anything said on today's show, leave us a comment. The link is in the show notes. Thanks once again to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and Typesense.org, and to Breakmaster Cylinder for supplying us with a steady stream of sweet, sweet beats. Next up on the pod, Austin Gill returns and has to fend off Nick, K-Ball, and yours truly, razzing him long enough to teach everyone all about uploading files on the web. Stay tuned right here. That episode will drop into your podcast feed next week.